as important as the middle, as the beginning. And then in fact, there's a kind of a very lots of potential Dharma learning, Dharma realization to happen as our mind begins to return to something like it was before you came. And hopefully not completely. But to watch the reconstruction, to watch the return, to watch the appearance of things from a new perspective. The danger is that some people say, well, mind's getting excited and busy. Well, the retreat's over for me. And then they just blow it off the last 24 hours and they just go into brilliant thoughts and fantasies. And unparalleled that the history has never seen before. It's so exciting. And so, but they're not really practicing anymore. But to hear that the practice the last 24 hours is as important, or maybe even more important than before, even though it isn't as pleasant or as concentrated or settled, it's still a really golden opportunity to learn a few things. One is to learn to have some degree of peace, equanimity, when things are more activated. The other is to be able to have a different kind of wisdom about how it is to be activated or busy or involved. And maybe there's a lot more compassion or a lot more equanimity about, here we go again, you know, as opposed to, oh no. And maybe there's something about the insubstantial nature of you, of your thoughts, your attachments, your desires, your concerns, your fears, that they have it, they're not quite as heavy or strong, or more, maybe they're more porous or lighter, or maybe they, for a little while, they have no weight. They haven't gotten their weight back yet. And so you start seeing them in a different way. Maybe you see the degree to which you give them authority. You give up your own personal authority in favor of some of these kind of quirks that some of us have. Not any of you, of course. And the end of the retreat kind of begins now, and we have the idea here at IRC is that there's kind of a rhythm of beginning to get a little bit more activity going, a little bit more energy happening, and then going back to sit, and then more energy tomorrow as we clean rooms, go back and sit, a little more energy, going to clean the center, go back and sit. And there's this kind of rotation, and it's meant to be a very important and carefully thought out way of coming back into being ready for the going back into your life. There are other ways of doing this integration part, but this is the way we do it here. And so I say that to you just so you realize that that's what the plan is. That's what's going on here. So you can participate in it that way, as opposed to just thinking, why are we working now? And, you know, I don't really need to stay for this anymore. They can clean. So the theme of the retreat, the five hindrances, the four Brahmaviharas, and this underlying sentiment of care. And so it was offering two sets of teachings. And this goes along with a kind of way in which the Buddha sometimes taught. We offered two different paths, two different options, two different things that he wanted to highlight or point to, one which led to suffering and one that leads to happiness. And that to have some sense that there is this division, there is a fork that we can take, and that some things are in the middle where they lead to some suffering and some happiness maybe, and it's a little confusing what to do. But basically that division is there to become sensitive to become aware of. One of the ways the Buddha taught about the five hindrances, he would pair it with the seven factors of awakening. And there we see this, you know, this example of this fork, one or the other. One is about what gets shut off or covered over, the hindrances, and the other what happens when we open up and see clearly the factors of awakening. And so we offer these two here today, this retreat. And we have the potential for both paths. We have the potential of becoming quite skilled in the hindrances. We're getting refined and capable and knowing how to pull them up at every possible juncture and, you know, and really kind of make a specialty out of it. We have that potential. They come with a lot of shortcomings. They come with a lot of problems for ourselves and for others. So, but we have that potential. We have also the potential to go the other direction, the potential to care, the potential to love and have compassion. We have the potential to move in the direction that causes the heart to sing, be happy and delighted with itself, as opposed to the heart gets obscured or lost even with the hindrances. And so we have these potentials, and to really have a clear sense of it, and then appreciation that maybe one path is better than the other. Better because it leads to happiness and peace and to care and to the welfare and happiness of others and yourself, and the other doesn't, leads the other way. So that this is a very clear dichotomy that the Buddha presents. But if you choose the potential of the hindrances, like you're going to specialize in that, or even if you don't want to specialize in it, you kind of accidentally, some of you accidentally fall into them sometimes. And so they're there, and you're doing that. From the Buddhist analysis of it all, the Buddha, if anything, there's no sense of it's a sin to do that. And it's not like you're a terrible person if you do that. The best the Buddha would get up to say, to call you something, say, you're kind of foolish. And the wonderful thing about being a fool is that, which is a little bit different than being a sinner, a fool can become wise. Sinners are a little bit harder. It's a little more complicated how that works. I don't quite know how it works. I don't know what a sinner is, but it's pretty bad, I've been told. And so the Buddha might call someone a fool for doing certain things in the world, but also there's a lot of respect for everyone. And what's remarkable is that this movement of care, the Buddha never talked about anyone cultivating the capacity to give care, like the way that the Brahmaviharas are practiced that you can do and develop. There's no practices around being caring. It's just assumed. But there are two things that seem to come along with this movement of care. One is respecting people, even to the point of a certain degree of reverence for people. We care for what we revere. We care for what we respect. And so to learn how to respect others and revere them and be able to see their beauty and their potential and their wholeness and in ways that they don't see for themselves often. And the other is letting go. That there's something about this Buddhist notion of care that arises most strongly when we're not clinging to anything, not holding on to anything. So if you want to care well, let go, which goes against the stream of how some people think they have to be when they're caring. You only show people you care because you get attached and you're holding on and you get upset or you're showing how much, you know, something. You're angry. Then they say, now I know the person cares. But, you know, for this anukampa, it's really something that flowers in the non-attachment, in the non-clinging. And that's nice because it means that non-attachment is not the same as non-caring, which some people are afraid of. But if you end up somehow accidentally going down the path of suffering and doing kind of the quirky things of the mind that people do, As I said, it's not a crime or sin. It's just, you know, practically it's a path of suffering. I get the sense when reading the ancient teachings of the Buddha that he really had a lot of respect for people. And when he viewed people kind of sometimes through the lens that everyone is royalty, that everyone is has a potential to be there's a wonderful, powerful word in Pali called naga. It's a serpent. It also means elephant. It's something big and powerful, but like apparently these serpents weren't so bad in ancient India that lived in the ocean, but they're powerful figures. So you can be a naga. And so they kind of seeing people with this kind of respect to the royalty is somehow. So when I was ordained, in 1982 I was ordained as a Zen priest. And I didn't really come from much of any religious background, and so rituals didn't kind of mean much for me. And I thought I wanted to be a monk. Later, after I was ordained as a monk, they said, a few months later, the abbot decided that we weren't monks, we were priests. And I said, what? What? What's a priest? I thought I was a monk. But in any case, so I wanted to be a monk, that was clear. But the ceremony, the ritual, was not just, I guess it's kind of like what you have to do, go through these steps and then you're a monk. And I didn't think about it much. But in terms, in fact, it was quite a transformative to do a ceremony like that. But one of the big changes was something like this, that I'd now become a public figure with shaved head and robes and in a way that I hadn't been before. And it was really clear because people would walk up to me on bus stops and feel like they could talk to me and tell me their life story. And in the way they hadn't before, I was just like this guy bumbling around San Francisco, and suddenly these people are like claiming me, like, you're the one who's going to hear my story. So I was a public figure, and so how I behaved was more public and visible. And that was, I didn't mind so much, but what it made, I think partly it made me much more conscious about my own personal shortcomings. And they stood out in the highlight for me. So normally that would maybe be kind of an unfortunate thing to see your own shortcomings even more acutely. But because of the ordination ceremony, I felt like now I was a child of the Buddha. So it was more okay to have those faults. And it wasn't like okay to have them, like now I'm going to just go, spill them out on people. I had the practice, I saw them, I was going to practice with them, I was going to try to do well. But this wonderful combination of seeing my faults more clearly and feeling, oh, it's okay. I don't have to fix them. I'm already a child of the Buddha. I'm already, And I learned in that process that when I didn't do that, in my language of the time, child of the Buddha, there's other ways of saying this. For me, that was just like, means I was accepted fully for what I was. When I didn't do that, I was going down the path of suffering. I wasn't contributing to my own kind of, difficult path. But when I accepted the fact that I was a child of the Buddha, the ceremony kind of allowed me to see it that way, then it put to rest all this kind of ways in which I dug my own grave. And it is this beautiful way of kind of just, it's okay. This is what it is. And I'll work with it. I'll try to do better with it. I'll try to, work with my anger. I had anger back then. And I'll try to figure out what to do and find my way. There's this beautiful story of the teacher of San Francisco Zen Center, Suzuki Roshi, who said something like, "Your He said, I think he said it to someone I know, but he said, you're perfect just the way you are, which is nice, right? Wow. And then, and by the way, there is some room for improvement. And to be able to hold both, I think, is brilliant. And so here we're offering you the hindrances, and we're offering you care. We're offering you the Brahmaviharas, love, compassion. You see how beautifully they go together? If you find, if by somehow in the next week or two, or sometime in the next year, you find you have a hindrance, you have something to meet it with. You have something to share with it. You meet it with your care, that you care, you're valuable, you're important, your well-being counts. You want to care for yourself. You want to do right, best you can. And maybe you can't. Maybe you're caught in some of the stuff that you do. But then there can be compassion for it. Or there can be kindness. It's kind of like you're a child of the Buddha already. And the Buddha is you, is that part of you that can love, that can hold it all, that's not going to condemn who you are, what you do, but it's going to be wise about it. It's not going to condone some of the odd quirks you do, but it's not going to condemn it. It's going to see that you have wonderful potential. There's room for improvement, and there's a possibility of turning the ocean liner to this beautiful way, and to have a practice that you can do, that's the purpose of it, that's the direction, step by step, no matter how slow it is, how halting it is, how challenging it is. We are so lucky to have a practice that goes in the wholesome direction, in the peaceful, loving, caring, happy direction. And what a great thing to have for a lifetime, to know that that path is always here. And maybe it's not so difficult to see the fork. And if you need help and signposts, one fork points to the hindrances. The other fork points to the Brahmaviharas and to Anukampa. And having those two signposts should be enough. You'll go really far just with that. So those are my summary words for our theme for this retreat. And here at IRC, it's not so common for us to do questions in the hall during the retreat, but we do that now, partly again for this rhythm of having more energy now. We're going to have this handheld mic, and if you guys want to ask any questions about the teachings this week, oh, you have it, thank you, or anything else, going home or anything, this is a nice time. And we realize some of you are in the other hall or elsewhere. So we'd love to hear your questions too. I think you have to probably get up and stand in the door, or maybe at some point Kodo will be carrying the mic around. Maybe you can go just peek in there and see if anyone wants. And those of you online, we don't really have a way for you to take any questions now, but Matthew and I will meet with you tomorrow morning at 9:15. And we'll go back and forth, Matthew and I, and that's the hope, to work that way.
You're welcome. Hi. Having been in psychotherapy for many years, dreams are a very important substrate of that work. And in my experience, they've been very powerful signposts of what's going on in my unconscious. does the Buddha talk about dreams at all or have something to say about them?
What are they laughing at? Oh, because they can see. Oh, I forgot that they can see us. We better be in our best behavior.
Yeah.
Not in any way that you would be benefit you. But I do have an article in the one of the IRC newsletters.
Uh-huh.
I think about practicing with sleep. And in there, I talk a little bit about how to practice mindfulness or vipassana approach to practicing with dreams. So you can find it on the IRC website.
Great. Thank you.
This is my third retreat here at IRC, and I'm really curious why we don't do metta practices during retreat. Like, even though the theme was the Brahma Viharas, it would seem like metta would be a natural kind of practice to have in the morning. Why is it that we don't do metta in retreat? Or at least the three retreats that I've been in, we haven't done metta.
Why didn't we do metta? It makes sense. There's a theme. We're trying to teach them that. What? Why didn't we do it?
Did I ask a silly question?
No.
Silly. It was not. Did you do any?
Yeah, I did. But I was wondering why it wasn't made a more formal.
This could not be going worse. In all honesty, I think it is a question of how the last retreat, I taught a retreat a week ago or something, and we had a metta session, but there is a little trade-off in terms of the simplicity and of the kind of day, and the sort of sometimes having too much actually adds some kind of ambient static. But no, it's beautiful to have that session, or to do it just on one's own.
Yeah, I think that's how I'd answer the question too. Is that we do so much through the day. To add one more thing like that, that kind of begins to detract from the focus of what we're trying to do here, the primary thing we're trying to do. So there's all kinds of things people would like to see us add, but by the time we add them, we're no longer an insight retreat center. So it makes sense to do it, and some teachers do. Some people do metta at the last sitting. And so I didn't really think about it. It didn't occur to me, partly because I think I was just in the mode that we usually never do that here. So, but it would have been nice, I think. And also about, you didn't ask a bad question. It's a little dangerous this last evening when we do this. I get kind of silly sometimes. and so you have to forgive me if I cross a line. Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'll do loving kindness tonight at the 9:00. There we go.
I think you gonna try the other hole? See if they
we allowed to talk now, or are we done with noble silence?
No. We continue in noble silence. And that's part of the important rhythm of the, we're kind of talking now a little bit differently, and then we go back into silence. And it's actually quite important for this process.
They won't know that you're speaking. You know, when they come to the door. Oh.
Okay. All right. They, or maybe it doesn't, maybe the hands help.
Question for you both regarding the hindrances and ill will. Is fear a part, it can be considered ill will or a precursor to ill will?
It's a good question, and because fear is such a common, it's so common, many people are trying to fit it into where the hindrances are. And it's unnecessary to make it fit into the hindrances. So that's just, you can, fear can just be its own thing. And also there's so many different kinds of fear. And there, in Buddhism, there's healthy fear, wholesome fear. And there's unwholesome fear that's not so good. So to be able to distinguish, so to make a categorical statement about fear doesn't, it's a little bit, you know, because of so many different kinds of fear. But the kind of fear, some people feel that their fear is involves some kind of hostility, and so it kind of fits that category. Or sometimes hostility is caused by fear, you know, it has a root rooted in fear. But this idea, the third hindrance, that rigidity, I think, like freeze, is often a symptom of fear. Fear is often freezing for people, you know, shutting down and becoming rigid. So it kind of fits there. And restlessness sometimes is also a symptom of fear, and so exactly where it fits, you know, it's. But
I mean, I think sometimes it's useful to have a kind of archaeological model of emotions where we have one thing and then we look under it, and it's sort of like, okay, we're excavating. Or sometimes that's very useful, and sometimes that those kind of archaeological models fail us, and we sort of don't want to apply it too haphazardly. I do think in the that fear responses can sometimes mobilize a lot of ill will and hatred, and that's worth looking at, looking into. But I don't know that it's the universal kind of rule or something like that. And I do feel like, you know, the way I've been sort of practicing with fear is as a quite a fundamental kind of the cauldron of fabrication, yeah, and the sense of so much of bhava tanha and becoming, what I was alluding to, as a function of a kind of like basic defense against samsara or something. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Please.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay. I am very thankful for the person who spoke about metta, because I thought, like, was I off in another planet somewhere? Did I completely miss that there was a metta practice at some point? So I was wondering the same thing. So thank you for that question. I am noticing the hindrance of desire arise. Desiring resources for people who may not have practices within the Brahmaviharas, like when we spoke about it, or like compassion and sympathetic joy, but for people who may not know how to cultivate that, is that something that could be offered?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's making me think, are there metta retreats here? You know, I don't know how often that's on the
the schedule, but it would be interesting to do. For me, they're really, I don't know, you can't, no matter what you're talking about, you can't help but be talking about love. You know, whether it's wisdom or fear or the hindrances or insight or becoming, at some level it ties into love. But I hear you. It's not, we've not taught it in a kind of explicit, structured kind of way. And totally legitimate to have retreats or practice periods that are focused on that. Yeah,
and it's also, I guess, a part of our own journey for us to venture out and get that for ourselves, too.
Yeah, two wings, you know. And like I'm curious what you think, Gil, but my sense is like, yeah, people tend to gravitate towards the cool, dry, equanimous, wisdom, piercing, pristine clarity side, or the juicy, warm love side. And my sense is to go where one is drawn for a while, go with one's natural inclination, and then we got to double back to the other wing or something like that and strengthen that, you know, to be in balance, really. It's my hit, for what it's worth.
So I think what I heard you ask was, for people who aren't ready or can't have access to Brahmaviharas, are there other alternative practices of what they can do to offer them so they can kind of get move in that direction? Was that what you were saying?
Well, my question was because during this retreat, it was talked about, but we weren't really like given like a guided practice that space. So if people wish to...
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I see. Yeah, that's right. Right, there wasn't that clear instructions of how to do it as a practice. Mm. Yeah.
But you offer it weekly with happy hour at IMC.
Yeah.
Try that.
But here's something. So the way I didn't quite understand, but I have a good answer for what I didn't understand.
Oh, okay.
There are people for whom the whole area of Brahmaviharas is inaccessible to them. They're like so frozen or so hurt or so something challenged that it's just, that's too hard for them, even painful for them or something. Or maybe it's just too strange for them, the idea of love, or all kinds of reasons. And so are there alternative ways? One of the things that I'm really hoping, I kind of a little bit counting on, we don't do metta here at IRC very much, like metta practice during retreat, but the whole field is a metta field. And so that's the alternative, the people who come in here, hopefully some sooner or later begin to feel the metta field, the friendliness, the care, the love that's here. And so it creeps in from the back door.
Thank you.
Hi. I have a question about forgiveness, but it might not fit that Q&A, and that's okay. But I'm curious, and I haven't read about it. How does it work? And what does the Buddha say? Because I, probably for more people than myself, but it comes up in places like these retreats. And like both like self-forgiveness, but also forgiveness for what has been done by others. And I'm curious, because it has been mentioned a bit, like there, things happened and we have this practice of forgiving, but what happens if they keep on happening? Like, do we just press a button and forgive again and forgive again? And... curious, and probably that's like a larger question, but what is being said about at some point not forgiving anymore and just choosing a different direction or doing something that's causing less harm to us?
You want to start and I'll add?
So it might be helpful to appreciate that forgiveness is a very important practice in the West. And it comes very much out of a theistic background where forgiveness is really important. If you don't get forgiven, it's like big deal. And Buddhism comes out of a non-theistic background. Buddhism is a non-theistic religion. So forgiveness doesn't have the same ultimate value and meaning. So it turns out that forgiveness is not really, historically, back in India, there's no word that really good match to describe what forgiveness is. But the need to do something like that was necessary, but it doesn't quite fit the Western ideas of what forgiveness is. And so letting you know what it is might kind of shift your understanding of how you might work with these challenging situations where it doesn't maybe have to be the classic idea of forgiveness with what and the associations with that. In the Buddhist, the comparable thing is in the early Buddhist tradition, or the Theravadan tradition, is work with your anger so you don't hold any anger. And keep your heart open. Have metta. Have care. And if you do those things, it'll look like forgiveness. But there's nothing about getting someone off the hook for what they did. And because Buddhism is a karmic religion rather than a theistic religion, forgiveness doesn't really... forgiveness helps socially, you know, with relationships, but it doesn't free a person from the karmic consequences of what they did. That's left to themselves. So I think there's another reason why forgiveness is not such a big Buddhist thing. But here in the West it has become, of course, but classically. So you might see how your relationship to all this might shift if you don't feel like you have to forgive, but it's really a task, your task, to free yourself of your anger and find a way to keep your heart open. How does that sound?
Thank you.
Maybe one more. Over here.
I was just sharing that for the last year or so, I've been doing the happy hour offered at IMC, and that has really taught me the practices of cultivating the Brahma Viharas. So for the people who are interested in that, the title happy hour confuses people. It's really metta. It's all about the metta. It's the only thing they cover is...
The only thing they drink is metta?
So my question was around this topic of fixing, and I've heard it many times now, is that Trishla, you're not a problem to be fixed, or you don't need to fix this, you don't need to fix yourself. And I was coming up against the Four Noble Truths as this idea that ultimately, the premise or the foundation of the entire religion is based on this idea that there is suffering, an arising, a cessation, and then there's the fix, the Eightfold Path, for lack of a better word. And the fix, you know, we can make it gentle, we can make it full of love, we can make it a tweak rather than a fix, we can call it letting go, but ultimately, isn't it a fix? And in that case...
So if you have a splinter in your foot, are you fixing Trishla when you take the splinter out? That's all there is splinters. You're fine. Trishla doesn't need to be fixed. Just, you might have a few splinters. But if you identify with a splinter, then it's a whole different animal. So the Four Noble Truths are about the splinters.
So it's important to distinguish between the suffering, and then the self part gets confusing. So the suffering is not Trishla.
That's right. And the cause of suffering is not Trishla. But there's still one. It's still good to take the splinters out.
So is this something that happens naturally in practice? That you can start to see that distinction between me and the splinter? Because it's really hard sometimes to see it.
Mm. You're using like all your smarts to try to get us to cop to the fact that you're broken, and it's not going to happen. You know? I love that. The splinter, and we do grow and evolve and get freer and all these things, but that is actually facilitated by not starting with wrong view. Yeah, namely my brokenness. Yeah. That is beginning in a sense with from a place of a certain kind of harshness or delusion or something, yeah. And so you just wanna be like very just very careful with your mind as it sort of runs loops around a kind of identification with brokenness. And it's like, no, you kind of like your joy and your pain and all of it. There's like this fundamental innocence in all of it. Yeah. And it's like in appreciating that kind of a certain kind of innocence, then we're really sourcing our motivation to change from love, not fear, not self-hatred. And so it feels very different. Like just how I relate to my foibles, my many of them, is very different, yeah? It's very different because it's not... My pain is no longer a commentary on who I am. Yeah. And then we're actually free to kind of revel in our strengths and our weaknesses and everything, and it all kind of means the same thing. And we're just like, yeah, of course we want to grow. Of course we want to be careful. Of course we want to not trespass on the hearts of others. Of course, but there's the kind of melodrama of egoic life and self-blame is like really can fall away very dramatically. Yeah, and that doesn't mean we're not responsible or accountable to harm we do or something like that, or can't distinguish skillful and unskillful. We can do all of that. But the nature of ego is melodrama, kind of, and it's just like, that can drop out, yeah? But we begin not with the sense of like chasing down the version of Trishla that's like always a little ways away, you know, like always kind of in reach and keeps you fragmented and dualistic, and you know, it's like that makes that's a painful starting point, you know? And so, look for kind of Yeah, all experience is innocent. Yeah, the innocent, and that's our starting point, and then we go from there. Yeah.
Okay. So thank you all for your questions, and nice to hear voices this way in this hall, and I kind of, most of you didn't ask questions, but I somehow feel greater appreciation for all of you. It's kind of something came alive here nicely. So thank you. In a few minutes, Kodo will do some announcements about the ending that we need to have. But this is a time where I'd like to kind of talk a teeny bit about IRC. As I said to May earlier when she asked about metta, and here that I'm hoping that the whole field is one of kindness and goodwill that we live in here. The fact that everyone here who's here is a volunteer. The fact that there's a lot of gratitude that's saturated these walls, and in the sense that so many people have offered freely their donations to help create this place in a way, it's phenomenal. And there's so much love. I mean, I know most of the decisions, I know who made them, for like the color of the walls, the light fixtures, the door handles, there's all these decisions. And I know the people who are involved in it, and there was so much love. It wasn't just like someone's job, it was someone whose love was loving this place into existence. And so the medium is the message, one of the important messages of IRC. And so the medium might be taken for granted and not been noticed, but I'd like at some point in the retreat to kind of highlight how special this is. And the fact that we could offer retreats for free in a place like this. I never would have imagined this was possible. I thought we were going to get a kind of retreat center which was going to be some kind of in the Santa Cruz Mountains in the shady redwoods in an old Boy Scout camp with this little bungalows with bunk beds and lots of mildew and mold. That's what I thought would happen, but because there was so much support that came pouring out, we ended up with this. And sometimes I'm embarrassed by what we have. It's so special and so nice. And but it's an expression of such so phenomenal amount of goodwill and generosity and compassion and people who want everyone to come here and experience this and be here. And it's not just to come here to experience a chance to sit and walk and to listen to the comedians. But it's to sit and walk and eat and be here and feel the support of people caring for each other, of people supporting each other, of this level of goodwill and generosity. And it's kind of my dream that people would come here, and there's something about how this is put offered and presented and supported that's contagious. That somehow you get the virus, and it's a long virus. And you take it with you to wherever you go, and you bring it into your communities. And maybe someone will create more IRCs out there in the world, because this is such a good thing for the world that we have this. So the medium is the message, and so there's a message here for you. There's a teaching here for you in the whole way that it's been put together. So Kodo.